Well, we're very happy to welcome Ian Job to our seminar. He will be talking about what are the allowed operations in quantum field theory. That's a very interesting question that's still open, I think, or I mean, he made a good progress on it. And yeah, we discussed earlier, and if you have a question, Ian is happy to take them during the talk, but just like raise the hand on Zoom and I will intervene. Yeah. So thank you very much, and you can start.
Great. Just thank you very much again for having me. It's a pleasure. As Philip was saying, I'm going to be talking about causal operations in quantum field theory. This is mostly going to be based on work that was published earlier this year in this paper on the right, but also on some work that came before with collaborators Laron Boursin and Graham Kells. Laron's at Harriet Watt University in Scotland, and Graham is now in Dublin City University. So just if I can jump straight in, there we go. An initial question that kind of sparked this work, and I guess not just for me, but for other researchers in the past as well, is the following. Is the textbook description of measurement in quantum theory the usual story in terms of states, operators, the projection postulate, is that consistent with relativistic causality in the setting of quantum field theory? Can we just import all of that usual machinery into QFT? QFT is, of course, a relativistic theory. It makes predictions in systems where relativity is really relevant. Particles moving in colliders are going very fast. But these predictions are coming from scattering amplitudes and then scattering probabilities, really, in the theory, which are approximations to the real system, in the sense that you're talking about states that are prepared in the infinite past, and then you're looking at the output states in the infinite future, and in some cases, measurements across all of space, which is, of course, an approximation to what's really going on. You really have a measurement, or your system that you are concerned about, concerned with, is finite in spatial extent, and you only care about it for some finite period of time. So then what if we ask more of quantum field theory, or more of the textbook description of measurement in that setting? Can we describe multiple spatially and temporally finite measurements in the same background spacetime? Now, one route that has been quite fruitful is to look at measurement models a la von Neumann, where you talk about unread width detectors or other probe fields more recently. You couple these auxiliary systems to the main system of interest, the main quantum field. You measure the auxiliary system and then infer from the results of that measurement the results of, say, the measurement of some observable of the main system. And in any case where you have some probe system like this and you trace it out, you'll get some update map for the main system of interest. And of course, you could keep going down the measurement chain. You could have, if you had another probe field, you could then have a probe field that couples to that probe field and so on. But here, I'll be talking more from the operationalist perspective, just in terms of the main system and the kind of update maps that are physically possible on the main system. Those that could arise, at least in principle, from some coupling to some auxiliary system. Maybe it's an unread width detector, maybe it's another probe field, maybe it's something we haven't thought of yet. What are the things that could arise, at least in principle? What are the things that don't contradict any, don't contradict relativistic causality? So that was all a kind of intro spiel. The main talk is going to be split up like this. We've got a setup and background. I have found that when I talk about quantum field theory, a lot of people mean a lot of different things about quantum field theory. So I thought I'd just say explicitly what I mean there. Then I'm going to talk about local operations in the theory. And this is coming from work that goes back to the 70s, kind of at the birth of AQFT. And then I'll talk about causal operations, starting with Raphael Sorkin's scenario that he first, I think he was first proposed in 1993. And then hopefully we'll get to the kind of general understanding of causality conditions. And then a short discussion at the end. Okay, so quantum field theory. For the talk, I'll just be thinking about real scalar field theory in Minkowski spacetime. A lot of what I said can, a lot of what I will say can be generalized to curved spacetimes. So let's say we have our field operator value distribution. I'm saying operator value distribution because it's not technically an operator on the Hilbert space, on the Fock space. And as you can see, I've got it as a function of time and space. So I'm thinking of this kind of implicitly in the Heisenberg picture, where the operators in the theory will be carrying the dynamics and not the state. And this should be kind of textbook to most people here, I imagine. But just in case, I've added this little box up here to show you what I mean by some of these symbols. We've got the energy for our three momentum P in terms of the three momentum and the mass of the field. And then we have the ladder operators satisfying the usual distributional commutation relations. So let's say we have some vacuum states, or the standard vacuum state in Minkowski spacetime. We can talk about the non-normalizable single particle states using the ladder operator on the vacuum state. And these are not normalizable in the sense that they are delta function normalizable. and then we get some actual states in the by essentially integrating these non-normalizable ones over LT functions of three momentum. And all states of this form will constitute our single particle Hilbert space H, from which we can then construct a bosonic one by taking symmetric tensor products. The self-adjoint operators in the theory, of course, will be corresponding to the observable quantities. And if we have some state or density matrix rho, then trace rho A is going to be interpreted as the expectation value of some observable, some self-adjoint operator. So that should all be very standard. and next, I'm going to go a little bit more down the AQFT or algebraic quantum field theory route. And to get a real operator out, we are going to smear or integrate this operator value distribution with some test function f. So you can imagine some function that's compactly supported in space and time, like I've just shown in this space-time diagram over here, showing the support of f. And we're going to integrate over space and time, integrate the operator value distribution against this f to get a smeared field operator. That's what I'll be calling it from now on. And I'm kind of overloading notation here in that I'm using the same symbol phi to denote a smeared field operator as well as an operator value distribution. You should be able to tell which I'm talking about from now on from the fact that you could inspect the argument. If the argument is a test function, then it's a smeared field. And if it's not, then it's an operator valued distribution. I said this is now an actual operator in the theory. So here's just an example of how it would act on one of the states in the theory. If we act on the vacuum state, then what you get out is a single particle state where we're smearing, integrating over these non-normalized three momentum states. And the function that we're integrating them against is the Fourier transform in 3+1 spacetime, the Fourier transform of the test function, but then evaluated on the mass shell. Now, the algebra that we'll be concerned with, the operator algebra here denoted by mathrak A, just corresponds to complex sums of products of smeared fields and the identity. So just here's an example polynomial in some smeared fields. And over here on the right, I've got a diagram showing the different possible supports that you could for this example. And we can also use functional calculus to go further and talk about functions of these smeared fields, like this complex exponential here, which would be a unitary operator in the theory. And in the algebraic approach, we'd be sometimes referred to as a vial generator. I've also, at the top here, just noted a reference, which I find really useful. It's an introduction to AKFT by Chris Fuster and Kasia Resner. Okay, so yeah, something important to note is the commutation relations between smeared fields. If I expand both these smearings, as in the integrals over space-time against f and g, the corresponding smearing functions, then I can use the standard commutation, space-time commutation relation for the operator value distribution, which just gives me something proportional to the identity, where the proportionality constant is I times the Pauli-Jordan function, which is just the difference of the retarded and advanced Green's functions for the theory. And the thing to note about the Pauli-Jordan function is that if I take my two points, Tx and T prime X prime, to be space-like to each other, or to be space-like, then the Pauli-Jordan function vanishes. Coming back over here, plugging that in, I can then, just looking at the second line, see that it looks like a smearing of the Pauli-Jordan function over its two arguments against the functions f and g. So on the last line, I'm again overloading the notation, and I'm going to write a sort of smeared Pauli-Jordan function. It's a function of the two test functions f and g. just to give you some more examples, from the picture I had on the last slide, the support of the test function f1 is space-like to the support of the test function f2, as you can see here by these light cones that I've drawn, these light-like lines. And since the Pauli-Jordan function vanishes for space-like points, then this I delta will vanish for those two test functions. And so the two smeared fields will commute whenever their supports are space-like. And then conversely, if the supports are not space-like, then you might not get them commuting. And this is kind of an important thing to note, that when we have two supports that are disjoint in space and time, like we have here with F3 and F1, it doesn't necessarily mean that the two smeared fields commute. The commutation relations really just care about whether they are space-like or not. Okay, going further for each region of space-time, so I have two regions here, R and R prime, I can just think about the smeared fields in each of those regions separately and generate the corresponding subalgebras from those two sets of smeared fields. And I'm going to denote those as mathrak A of R and mathrak A of R prime. And for every operator that I generate in the left, say A, and every operator I generate in the right, say A prime, they're going to commute because they're generated by smeared fields that commute. and this is referred to as Einstein causality, that subalgebras associated with space-like regions commute. In terms of a kind of non-relativistic or bipartite Hilbert space picture, you can imagine any two space-like subalgebras being like the two different parts of the bipartite Hilbert space. Okay, so that was a little brief intro to quantum field theory, or how I'm going to use it. Now let's talk about some local operations. The first most standard thing to consider is an ideal measurement associated with some diagonalizable self-adjoint operator. So imagine I have some A and some subalgebra for some region R, and it's self-adjoint. And that by diagonalizable, I mean I can write it as a sum over distinct eigenvalues lambda n times the associated projectors Pn. Then the non-selective ideal measurement amounts to the state update where rho goes to this thing that I've called E tilde superscript 0a of rho, which is simply just a sum of the projectors acting on either side of rho. The subscript a here is telling me which operator I'm doing a measurement with respect to, and the superscript here I'm going to be using to denote the fact that it's an ideal measurement. Having an update rule like this is just useful for then calculating expectation values of other operators that you might measure in the future. And the way that you do that is you take the trace of this new state against those operators. And then we can, from that, then get a dual map, which I've sort of removed the tilde to denote that it's the dual map now, that acts on the operators instead of on the state. And that's what I'll be focusing on throughout, is actually the dual map, which updates operators as opposed to the states. So bringing that map up to the top now, let's consider the space-like case. That is, if I'm going to be measuring some operator A in the subalgebra for R, and I then think of some other subalgebra in a space-like region R prime and some operator B belonging to that subalgebra, then those two operators commute, but also the projectors for A will commute with B. And that means that when I act on this operator with my ideal measurement update map given by this, then the P will commute through and square to itself. But then you've just got a sum of operators that we are saying here resolve the identity. And so this just evaluates to the identity and you end up with B. That is, the ideal measurement update map acts trivially on an operator B that is localized in a space-like region to that of A. And this is then true in general. So the way that I would write that is that this ideal measurement update map acting on any on a subalgebra for any space-like region just acts as the identity. Just to give you some more examples that I'll be using throughout, especially this one, I wanted to talk about unitary kicks, where I would say I'm unitarily kicking with some operator A, and explicitly the map is B goes to UA of B, where I'm just hitting it on either side by the unitaries associated to A. Again, it's the same deal. If you have some other operator that's localized in a space-like region to that of A, then the two operators commute, and so the unitaries pass through and cancel each other, and you just end up with B. So again, we have the same condition as before. If U of A is acting on the subalgebra, anything in the subalgebra for some space-like region, then it acts as a identity. Finally, another map of note that I was looking at in the most recent paper, because it was just simpler, technically speaking, to study than the case of ideal measurements, is this map update map that arises when you're talking about weak measurements. That is, if you couple in some other system in some way that gives rise to this, once you trace out that other system, gives rise to this kind of Gaussian map, where you are hitting the operator B on either side by Gaussians of the operator A that you're measuring, and then you integrate over this real number alpha from minus infinity to infinity. Also in the map, I've got the superscript sigma here. Sigma is just some positive real number denoting the width of the Gaussians. If you have an operator A that is diagonalizable, you can write it as a sum of projectors, then in the limit that sigma goes to zero, you have this this weak measurement map tends to an ideal measurement map. But even in the case where you don't have a diagonalizable operator, you can still talk about this weak measurement update map. And in fact, even in the case where you don't have a diagonalizable operator, you can talk about an ideal measurement map. It's just that the projectors that you put in, there's no canonical choice for them. The projectors can be thought of in a functional calculus way as indicator functions for some interval or Borel subset more generally of the spectrum of the operator you're considering. Anyway, that was a bit of a technical aside. Back to this case of weak measurements. Again, we've got the same deal as before. If we're acting on space-like operators, then it acts trivially. So we've seen that property in every one of these maps. So let's just formalize that. I'm going to call a map local, specifically just talking about completely positive trace preserving maps. I'm going to say they are local to a region R if for any space-like region and any algebra, any operator in the subalgebra for that space-like region, if the map acts trivially on that operator. And this is going to be my general go-to notation for a map that's local to R. I'll put the region R in the subscript. When I say trace preserving here, because I'm talking about dual maps, that condition would amount to the operator, these maps acting trivially on the identity. And then this Einstein causality condition from before, that space-like subalgebras commute, ensures that any map constructed from some local operator in some functional way, like those that we've seen, so either by taking the complex exponential of that operator or by taking a Gaussian, or in the case of an ideal measurement, taking an indicator function to get the associated projectors, any sort of functional way that you could construct a map from a local operator will lead to a local update map, or Einstein causality ensures this. And what's nice about this locality condition is that it ensures that expectation values and probability distributions associated with any space-like operators are unchanged. If I was to look at the expectation value of some operator in a space-like region to R, then this map would act trivially on that operator, and so it would actually just be the same as if that operation hadn't happened. And this makes sense from a causal perspective. So all of this was essentially formalized at least as far back as 1970 by Helwig and Krauss. At least that's one of the main references that I know. And the idea is that if you have some region R and some local map that describes some operation happening in R, then we want, the way we would use it is we would act on any operators that are not to the past of R, because we want to use this map to tell us how expectation values are updated to the future of R, but also for operators that say straddle the future light cone of R. And if an operator is entirely space-like to R, so over here somewhere, then this map by Einstein causality will act trivially on that operator. And so that's why we're talking about operators that are not to the past of R. We're covering the case of to the future and potentially space-like. And then in Helwig and Krauss, they talk about multiple local operations. So if we have some other region R prime and some other local operation happening in R prime, then we would do a composition of these two update maps for anything that is not to the future of R prime and R. So in the region above this line here, we would be using ER on ER prime on any operators to update them to get the corresponding expectation values for any operators in that region. One thing to note is that this might be the opposite order for the composition that you might expect, but that's because we're talking in terms of the dual picture where the maps are acting on the operators and not on the state. And then one can keep going like this and adding as many local operations for as many regions as possible, composing things in this way. If instead of just talking about local maps to these regions, we also specified some local operators in those respective subalgebras and constructed local maps in some functional way. So we take A and say this EA could be a unitary kick with A, for example, and this EA prime could be a weak measurement with respect to A prime. then we have the same story. And in particular, if the two regions are space-like, then the two update maps will commute on whatever they're acting on And this is ensured by Einstein causality again. And this makes sense in that expectation values won't change, or they won't depend on which way around we apply these two updates. And that makes sense again from a causal perspective. Observers with different reference frames could, in their reference frame, see the operation in R happening before R prime in this case, and vice versa. Some other observer could see the operation in R prime happening before R. But the results for any expectation values, the sort of physical content should be invariant under that. Okay, so that was local operations. And now I want to turn to Sorkin's initial contribution, the scenario that he posed, I think, in 1993. Because I'm in Ireland right now, and the original work was done with a couple people here in Ireland, we, instead of going with the usual Alice, Charlie, and Bob, we went for some very Irish names, traditional Irish names, which has definitely been quite fun giving this talk at other places and having people try and ask questions and say these names without having heard me say them yet. Unfortunately, here I'm going to pronounce them before you get a chance. So consider three agents, Aoife, Caoimhe, and Beola, acting in their respective regions. So Aoife's in this region R1, Caoimhe in R2, and Beola in R3. And the way that we're setting things up is, as you can see by the light cones, Aoife is going to be space-like to Beola, and Caoimhe's region is going to be such that some parts are to the future of some parts of Aoife's, and some parts are to the past of some parts of Beola's. And one other thing to note is that Aoife's region will definitely not, no parts of Aoife's region will definitely not be to the future of Caoimhe's. And no parts of Beola's region will be to the past of any parts of Caoimhe's region. So with this setup, Aoife will perform a local operation described by some update map, ER1. Caoimhe will perform a local operation described by some update map ER2. And then Beola will then measure the expectation value of some local self-adjoint operator. So with the setup, the space-time setup, we know that the local map for R1 will act trivially on Beola's operator. By definition of it being local, it acts trivially on anything that's space-like to it. But this won't necessarily be true for Caoimhe's map, and that makes sense. Beola's region being partly to the future of Caoimhe's region, if Caoimhe's doing some physical operation in that region, then that might affect the results of Beola's measurement. So let me just put all that to the side. our composition rule from before, where we compose maps for multiple operations that are happening in different regions, would tell us to calculate the expectation value that Beola is going to measure using this trace, where we compose the maps in this particular order. Again, the one for Caoimhe's region happening first. But at the same time, Aoife is causally disconnected or space-like from Beola. And so Beola's expectation value physically should be the same as if Aoife was not there. No effects from Aoife could have been translated across to Beola. And so this expectation value should be the same as the expectation value calculated without Aoife's map at all. And if we're asking this to be true for all states in the theory, then as an operator equation, this is what we want, is that the composition of the two maps is the same as just acting with the second map. The first map just essentially peels off whenever the region R1 is space-like to the region for which A3 is a element of the associated subalgebra. But the Einstein causality rule that we were using before does not ensure that this is necessarily true for every such local operation. Imagine now that this, if we find an example where this is not true, then you can imagine that for some state, we can then find that the expectation values from left to right are not equal. But then what this means is that Biola can tell to within some confidence level, because this is at the level of an expectation value, it's to do with statistics, whether IFA has acted or not based on the differences in the expectation value that Biola measures. So on the left-hand side, Biola would then know that if they get this expectation value, that IFA has acted with their local map ER1, whereas on the right, they would be able to tell that IFA has not acted. And this difference can allow IFA to signal Biola, but clearly this can't be possible in this setup since such a signal would have to travel faster than light. So if we get these two things being not equal, then there's something that we have to address. I also want to compare this to some work by from the early 2000s by Beckman, Presco, Gottesman, and Nielsen, where they were looking at bipartite Hilbert spaces and thinking about causal and localizable operations. And there's a lot of similarities that can be drawn there. IFA's region in this case is like part A of the Hilbert space, and Biola's region is like part B of the Hilbert space. Of course, in this setting, these two things could just be qubits, and we're not necessarily asking that any operations that happen on the two qubits are space-like. It's just that they should be disconnected in some way or causally disconnected. Then Cuiva's action is analogous to some operation on both, say, both qubits. And then what we're asking here is the same or analogous to asking whether or not Cuiva's operation can allow IFA to signal Biola. And if you have an operation, even in a non-relativistic scenario, if we have some operation that Cuiva can implement on the system, it may be possible to implement that in practice in a laboratory experiment. But if it's allowing a signal from IFA's qubit to Biola's qubit, then you would say, and as Beckman et al. Said, you cannot implement that faster than light, because if it's allowing a signal to go between the two qubits, you cannot implement that faster than the light travel time from qubit A to qubit B. Because if you were to implement it faster, then you would have enabled a signal that would travel faster than light. But in this potentially non-relativistic scenario, that operation done by Cuiva could be implemented just at a slower rate. And it might even involve some classical communication from site A to site B. This is kind of in contrast to the relativistic setting where the space-time locations of any actions are actually baked in. And so if we get a signal in our case, then it just means that Cuiva's map cannot be implemented at all. Okay, so back to what we had before, the relativistic case. I also wanted to point out actually that this question of whether or not the left and right hand sides are equal, whether or not the operation in the region R1 can be peeled off, could apply even if the map ER2 corresponds to something happening in a region that isn't even compact. We could still ask the same question. And so essentially now we're separating out the two properties of a map, the locality and the causality, in the same way that Beckman et al. Did. We can ask whether or not a map is causal and or whether or not it's local. Okay, so that was kind of a general overview or intro, but now I thought it'd be good to go through some specific examples of causal and acausal maps. So here's a causal example that's one of the simplest ones. Imagine we start in the vacuum state And then IFA performs some local operation, which can be described in the theory by this unitary kick, with a smeared field smeared in her region. So the support of F1 is contained in this region, say. That smeared field unitary kick is just where you hit the operator on either side by the corresponding unitaries. Then Quiva does the same type of map, but for a smeared field in her region. And finally, Biola just measures some smeared field at 5F3 in their region. So let's do the calculation. the expectation value we'd write down for Biola is this, where again, I'm composing these two maps in the order we saw before. The first map that hits Biola's operator is the one corresponding to Quiva's region, and then you hit it with IFA's. Expanding everything out on the right-hand side, we can then use essentially the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula to work out what the first two unitaries acting on phi would give us, and using the fact that 5F3 and 5F2, their commutator is given by this non-vanishing Pauli-Jordan, smeared Pauli-Jordan function. So this part in the middle becomes 5F3 plus something proportional to the identity. And the proportionality constant is exactly this smeared Pauli-Jordan function. Next, we can just note that the smeared fields for IFA's region commute with Biola's operator 5F3 because they were space-like in this picture. And so they would pass through. And of course, we've got something proportional to the identity here. So the unitaries pass through that as well and cancel each other out. And so we're left with this line. And then finally, because we've picked this particular, the standard vacuum state, then the one-point functions vanish. And so we just end up with the constant piece, the Pauli-Jordan, the smeared Pauli-Jordan function. And what's then nice about this is that there's no dependence on IFA's test function F1. And that's how her influence in this situation has dropped out when we're looking at Biola's expectation values. And so in this case, we have a causal scenario. Slightly changing things, we can get an acausal scenario. So this is almost spot the difference from the last slide because it's so similar. But we have here, everything else is the same apart from Quiva's operation. Now, instead of doing a smeared field kick with 5F2, we're doing a kick with 5F2 squared. So again, 5F2 squared is some self-adjoint operator, so we can form the associated unitaries and do the kick like this. And what happens now when we do the calculation is, in this first step, we don't get the same thing on the next line. In fact, we get 5F3, but now minus some constant times 5F2. Again, just using the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. But now this changes things because while the unitaries will commute through 5F3 because F1 and F3 have space-like supports, that won't be true for the unitaries and this 5F2 over here. They won't commute through that because in the picture, the support of F2 is not space-like to the support of F1. And so we can forget about the 5F3 term again, because once the unitaries commute through, then we're going to be left with a one-point function which will vanish. And so just focusing on this last term, when the unitaries act on 5F2, what we get is 5F2 minus the Pauli-Jordan for F1 and F2, which is non-zero. And then simplifying things again using the vanishing one-point functions, we get our final result in terms of the Pauli-Jordan functions for the three test functions. And it's exactly the kind of Pauli-Jordan functions that are non-vanishing in this case, F1 to F2 and F2 to F3. But here we now have to have a dependence on IFA's test function F1. And so if IFA does this operation, then Biola's expectation value will give us, you know, this answer. But if we took away IFA's operation, we would get a different answer. And so in this case, IFA can signal Biola. There's a raised hand.
Yeah, it's I think it's a good time to ask the question. So these unitary kicks, is it how can you say how this the Hermitian operator, like in the subscript, like here phi of F1, is it equal to the interaction Hamiltonian that you would need to apply in order to perform it, or is it more complicated than this?
I don't know. That's a good question. I had tried to think about something along those lines for just the smear field kicks on their own, but I hadn't got anywhere conclusive. And so I don't know, but it would be nice to frame these acausal maps in that sort of a way where you can see, oh, the interaction unitary that you'd have to apply is clearly doing something acausal. Okay. But yeah, no, that's not done yet.
Okay, thanks.
Cheers. Okay, so so here's just a simple acausal example. In the paper I was talking about before, I give a few other examples and I talk about the weak measurement update maps as well. And it seems like smeared fields are generally causal, but if you do anything else, if you consider any polynomials of smeared fields that are higher than degree one, then you run into problems. Okay, so those were just some examples, but now it'd be good to work towards a nice classification of when you have causal or acausal map. So formalizing what we have so far, here's our kind of three regions from before, but now I've got the first one just denoted by R, and then some space-like region R prime, and I have my map in question in the middle. This is going to be Cuevas' map, and we're using this setup again to say whether or not the map in the middle is implementable by any physical system. And so maybe just to reiterate from before, the 5F2 squared kick is clearly not implementable by any physical process. If it were, then you would get these pathological causality violations. Okay, so here's just a definition. A map E is causal with respect to some map ER local to R. If for all R prime that's space-like to R, as we have in this diagram, and all operators for R prime, then as we were talking about before, ER just peels off. And so the action of ERE on A prime is just the same as E on A prime. And this will ensure that the expectation values of operators like A prime in regions that are space-like to R will be unchanged by the action of ER. In other words, the map E is not sort of propagating the signal from the region R or allowing it to affect expectation values in space-like regions R prime. Without reference to any particular A prime in the space-like region R prime, we could just write the above equation like this. So whenever it's acting on any subalgebra for a space-like region, it just acts as E. Right now, this condition is phrased in terms of some local map ER. I'm saying it's causal with respect to such a map. So what we can do is, I'm jumping ahead of myself. In this picture, I drew a compact region for E, but as I was saying before, we could even consider regions still ask the same question. And so we just have some map. We don't really need to know about where it is, but we're just asking whether or not it is causal with respect to some other local map. Oh, there's another hand.
Is that condition? So it seems like it's necessary. Is it also sufficient? Because you can imagine more complicated scenarios where you had R, R prime, R double prime, and so on. And it's not so theory. People cover those.
Multiple regions.
Yeah. Like it might be that if you've got two regions, then the map is always causal, but you can find ways to bring out some acausality in it. If you...
Yeah. No, that's a good question. And actually, this is all you need to talk about. So when we get to our kind of nice classification of the causal maps, at least in real scalar field theory, I should say,
okay.
then what we find out, it will be sufficient to ensure that any composition of such maps will not allow any signals to propagate.
Sorry, Kate, can I also ask a question? You said now it doesn't matter where it's localized, but the order of composition seems to imply that it should actually be in, right, not in the causal past of
R. Oh, yes, sorry, no, I absolutely, yeah. So it's definitely not in the causal past of ER, and that's really what I should have said, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So before we had causal with respect to some local map ER, but then a kind of obvious condition for whether or not a map is just causal period is whether or not it's causal with respect to all local maps, local to all regions R, or any region R. but this condition, as stated, might be a little strong, or you might worry that it's a bit strong, because we're then asking for a given map to be causal with respect to all local maps, ER, but what if those maps are not causal with respect to some other maps down the line? Why would we want our map E to be causal with respect to those aphysical maps? And so for that reason, I just temporarily, we'll call this strongly causal instead. So a map is strongly causal if it's causal with respect to all the local maps. In terms of a Venn diagram, just as a nice way to lay out some of the examples, we have all the local maps here. Those are the ones that act trivially on any operators in space-like subalgebras. over here, we have the strongly causal maps that are causal with respect to all these local maps. That's what this arrow is representing. And some of the examples we just saw, we had the smeared field kicks. They were causal, or strongly causal, I should say, and they were local. The smeared field squared kicks were local, but they were not causal. In my paper, I also talk about some other examples, the weak measurements of the smeared fields. They're causal and local. Weak measurements of fields squared, smeared fields squared, they're not causal. And again, you could think about these maps, but for other polynomials of higher degree than one. More generally, instead of just talking about Gaussian measurements, where you take a Gaussian function of the smeared field, you could imagine taking some real L2 normalized function instead of a Gaussian, denoted here by G, of that smeared field, shifting it and then integrating against that shift in the exact same way that we did for the weak measurements. And all those kind of maps are also causal. I think I also considered at least one example of a LOC protocol, a local operations and classical communications protocol, where you had one region and did a smeared field weak measurement in that region. And then based on the result, so it was a selective weak measurement, based on the result, the outcome, you either did or didn't do another weak measurement, a non-selective one, for some other smeared field in the future of that region. And that was also causal as well. So it seemed like there was a whole host of things you could try to write down that could be very interesting to see which things turn up to be causal or not causal. Just like the Beckman et al. Paper, there are also examples that are strongly causal but not local. And they're not too hard to construct, but I won't go into the details right now for time, but they're very close to the unitary kick with the smeared field, or the weak measurement with respect to a smeared field. And you can show that they're causal in the exact same way, but not local. And you could also go further and write down some maps that are both not local and not causal, such as these. You could change these maps, modify them so that instead of being the non-local analogs of these, you're talking about the non-local analogs of these, say. So really, we can get all combinations here of strongly causal and local. So now, with that condition for strong causality, I would like to talk about a sufficient condition that gives you a strongly causal map that will be useful in going forward. To do that, I just wanted to introduce the idea of the commutant. So given some subalgebra, the commutant is, as it sounds, it's the set of all algebra elements that commute with that given set, denoted here with a superscript, the perpendicular symbol. And in real scalar quantum field theory, if we're considering the causal complement, which is given by the space-like, the parts in the space-time which are space-like to a given region R, then you can imagine for any space-like region R prime, the subalgebra for that region will be inside this commutant because it commutes. Any operator in this region commutes with, by Einstein causality, with any operator from A of R. And then we have this Hagg duality property for real scalar field theory, where the commutant for a given subalgebra of R is actually just the same as the subalgebra for the causal complement, the space-like region. So with that, then here's the sufficient condition for strong causality that was more amenable to calculation. I've called it commutant non-increasing, or CNI. So a map is CNI, commutant non-increasing, if for all regions R, it does not increase the commutant. So A of R perpendicular here. That is, if you think of any operator in a space-like region to A of R, and you act on it with your given map, that map is commutant non-increasing if it leaves you in this space-like subalgebra. Now, if you then pick any map that's local to R, so E subscript R, by definition of it being local, it acts trivially on the commutant. It acts trivially on anything that's space-like to R. But that means if we then were to, say, compose E of R with this commutant non-increasing map and act with something in this space-like region, so that's what we have on the left-hand side, then because E acting on this something in the space-like region is going to still be within the space-like region by the commutant non-increasing definition, then E of R will act trivially on it. And so actually we can just peel the E R off. But this is precisely the condition for strong causality from before, that whenever you're acting on a space-like subalgebra to the local map, that the local map just peels off. So in fact, the CNI maps are strongly causal. So let's just add that to the diagram. So here I've got the CNI maps right now just living inside the strongly causal maps. And the arrow again is denoting what they are causal with respect to, all these local maps, at least. As I was saying before, the condition for strong causality might be too strong, because we're asking for maps here to be causal with respect to all the local maps, even maps like these, which were not causal to some other maps. So what if we instead were to think about a kind of subset of more physically or viable maps, like the ones in this region here, those that are local and, say, strongly causal in this case. These are the ones that are kind of the best candidates right now for maps that you could actually implement in some physical process. They're local and causal. So if we think about now the maps that are causal with respect to just this subset, then we get this larger set that I've just called the weakly causal maps. It's larger because it's causal with respect to a smaller subset than the strongly causal maps were causal with respect to. And that's what this arrow here denotes. It's pointing into this smaller subset. You can imagine going on and on like this. You could think about all the different kind of subsets we're making here, thinking about the maps that are causal with respect to them and so on. But actually, in this case of real scalar field theory, we don't need to, because all of these things just collapse to just one subset of CP and trace preserving maps, the causal maps. And the way that they collapse, or at least the way that I went through was, already we have that C and I maps are strongly causal, which are weakly causal. If we can then show that weakly causal implies C and I, then we're done. All of them collapse together. So let's show that, or just I'll give you a quick rough argument why the weakly causal maps are C and I. By the definition I just gave, a weakly causal map E is causal with respect to all the strongly causal local maps. So everything in this intersection of strongly causal and local. And this is true for all regions R. But as you can see in this diagram, inside that region are the unitary kicks for smeared fields 5F, where F is supported in R. So this means that any weakly causal map is causal with respect to a smeared field, a smeared field unitary kick. And what that means from our definition of causal with respect to is that if we were to act, take some region R and take some test function localized, supported in that region. If we were then to compose the kick with our weakly causal map E and act on anything in the commutant or the space-like subalgebra, then the unitary kick would peel off. And this has to be true for any test function compactly supported in this region R, and for all regions R. But this condition is actually quite useful because it allows us to deduce that, say you had some operator A in the causal complement of R, and then we're acting on that with E first, so we get E of A. Then because the unitary kick peels off, then you can show that E of A actually commutes with all the smeared fields in R. And so because they generate the subalgebra A of R, it commutes with everything in A of R, i.e. E of A is in the commutant of the subalgebra A of R. But where did A start? A started in that commutant. So, oopsie-daisy. So from that we get that if you start in the commutant, then E acting on that gives you something that's still in the commutant. That is the condition of commutant non-increasing. And so bar some technical stuff, we're done. And we have this picture now where the causal maps are just precisely those that are C and I, commutant non-increasing. And so this is kind of a nice summary, I guess, of everything I've said up to this point, that we introduced local maps, the idea of local maps, the idea of causal maps, and I give you some examples, the unitary kicks, the weak measurements. I also just briefly mentioned these non-local examples that were still causal. And then finally, we just now talked about the equivalence between that definition of a causal map and this commutant non-increasing condition. So that was the summary of the talk, but I thought I'd just run through a few open questions that I'm interested in. So here's our Venn diagram from before. The first question, just because it was technically challenging, is where do ideal measurements fit in? Like if I had some self-adjoint operator A, and I was looking at the ideal measurement update map, it's certainly local if A is a local operator, but where does it fit in? In some recent work with a student, Emma Albertini at Imperial College, we were focusing on the case of ideal measurements for just smeared fields on their own, the the simplest thing you could consider. It's still quite technically challenging, but it looks to be that ideal measurements for smear fields would actually lie outside. They would be acausal. And given that, then you might wonder if there's a nice reasonable substitute for this, the kind of basic ideal measurement or the projection postulate in quantum field theory. From what I've seen so far, these sort of weak measurement update maps are the more general maps with respect to some L2 function G. Could be a good route to go down there. but yeah, a lot more work needs to be done. And we've only been able to just look at the case of the smeared field in the corresponding ideal measurement. Another question is, I've just been talking about real scalar field theory. What does this picture look like for, you know, fermionic field theory and gauge theory? Together with Laurent Boursin, one of my collaborators from before, where we've managed to generalize this picture in a slightly different way. And it looks to be that this idea of CNI maps does actually generalize to those cases. But again, that it's too early stages to be 100% sure of those results. And then, yeah, a final question is, I guess, kind of came up throughout the talk, is whether these causal maps and can be realized via local couplings to some auxiliary systems, local in terms of like local locally coupled Lagrangians, for example. And this would be a local analog of the Stein-Springs dilation theorem, where any update map can be written as a unitary acting on a larger system, and then you trace out the auxiliary system. But in that theorem, it doesn't necessarily talk about the locality of any of those couplings, locality in space and time. So that's what we would be looking for here, a kind of restricted version of that theorem. Okay, that was everything. Thank you very much again. And yeah, any further questions?
Thank you very much. I really appreciated it. So yes, please, questions if you have. Ding, you can go.
Thank you, and thanks for the nice talk. I've been following your papers on this topic. Found very enlightening.
Thank you.
Yeah, and this is a question. This is a quantum foundation seminar, so it's a bit more foundational flavored question. I wonder if you thought about the perspectival aspects of QFT.
The what aspects?
Perspectival or a single Wigner's friend thought experiment. We have Wigner, we have his friend. They, by assumption of the thought experiment, they see different things. Wigner thinks the friend can be in superposition, or the friend thinks he's not. Mm-hmm. And in this case, if I try to translate it to your scenario, it could be that A, in her own perspective, to describe her own experience, she thinks I put on this unitary cake or something, some operation.
Mm.
From the perspective of B, he's like Wigner. He thinks A has done nothing. It's just not the original dynamic of evolution. And in this case, it seems possible if we take this kind of interpretation, which is adopted, the general perspectival interpretation, which is adopted in cubism or relational quantum mechanics, maybe there's a way out to say that there is no signal, superluminal signaling in the perspective of B.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that all sounds really like a nice, interesting direction to go down. Not one that I've thought about. But I have, you know, come across many papers on Wigner's friend. What was I reading the other day? perhaps it was Philippe, have you done something yourself on that? Maybe it was one of your papers. It was to do with the joint probability distributions in time. Yeah. So that's just struck me as something that I don't know how that would look in terms of these, when you have this space-time setup, you have different regions in time.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry. No, there's not really much of an answer there. I haven't thought about that too much, but I would like to, or we'd like to talk more about that, yeah.
Thanks.
Lucian.
Hi, thanks for the talk. There's a lot to think about. So let me just understand. So you have the maps that are local, maybe you can just give me the definition of what you mean by that again. That's satisfying the Einstein locality condition, or
the local maps were the ones that we're talking about, maps acting on algebra elements. So if they act on elements which are localizable in space-like regions.
Okay, that means local.
To where the map is acting on, then the map acts trivially.
Okay, right. Okay.
I can bring up my
slides. No, I remember the definition. You don't need to bring it up now. Okay. I remember you said that. And the causal, or the strongly causal maps are ones that if they're in that middle position, they don't allow any crosstalk, basically. I mean, you had a more precise condition, but that's okay. The maps that would be physically allowed would be the maps that were in the intersection. Is that right, or could you imagine
that? That's what I would
the intersection. And were you throughout considering just trace preserving maps? Because if you have trace decreasing maps, say in the middle position, in Quiver's position, I think it was. If you had trace decreasing maps, then actually you wouldn't necessarily expect that condition to be satisfied, I think.
Steering or something. Talking about trace decreasing maps where you might be, physically thinking about conditioning on certain outcomes, then I wouldn't be applying that condition in that case.
So you're only considering trace preserving maps throughout?
Yeah.
Okay.
The kind that I would think of as being physically like those where no communication is happening between the participants.
Okay.
Or doesn't have to happen.
And so at this stage, do you have a if someone presents you with a map, do you have a necessary and sufficient condition to say if that map is in the intersection region where you think the physically permissible maps are?
To test whether or not it's local for a specific map is pretty easy, I'd say, for any kind of ones that you would concoct functionally from the operator elements. But to figure out whether it's commutant non-increasing, the causal property is the hard part. When I was looking at the unitary kicks, and rather than just thinking about a smeared field, I went and looked at smeared field squared, smeared field cubed, and so on, all these different polynomials. If the smeared fields in the polynomial didn't necessarily commute, so you could be talking about two smeared fields that were time-like related, then the calculation got really tricky. And I actually only did one example like that, where it was two time-like related smeared fields, a kind of symmetrized product, I think, and then you kicked with that. And that was a causal, but it wasn't like I was able to consider all possible functions of smeared fields. and like I was saying as well at the end, just thinking about ideal measurements was also a challenge as well. It's easy to show that all those things are local, and essentially that, I'd say that was done back in the 70s.
So it's the status is that you have a necessary and sufficient condition, but it's difficult to actually do a calculation to see if it's satisfied or not.
Yeah, that's a nice summary. Okay. And so that leaves open then an avenue to explore, which is, can we come up with a more useful condition? And if you just stick to some simpler class of operators like the smeared fields, say, mm-hmm. you don't think about any other operators in the theory, so we're just talking about the generators, then maybe you can think about all the possible maps that you could construct just with just out of a single smeared field, and which of those are causal and not causal.
Okay.
That'd be one route.
Okay. Great, thanks. That's good. I got.
Do we have more questions? Otherwise, I have a question. What you said about the ideal measurements, I found surprising because I would expect that when you take the limit of sigma goes to zero, you get weak measurements.
Oh, right.
You would get an ideal measurement, and then you would, at every finite value of sigma, you're inside the, the good region. So what is it, more like a mathematical subtlety, or is there some content physically?
It might lead to some physical insight, but the problem with taking sigma to zero for the weak measurement map is that that's not necessarily defined for unbounded or non-diagonalizable operators like the smeared field. A smeared field acting on the Hilbert space, if you start with a vacuum state, it's mathematically analogous to just having, a Gaussian function in X and acting with a position operator. The Gaussian function being like the vacuum state, and then the position operator being like the smeared field. And so it's an unbounded operator, and you wouldn't be able to take that kind of sigma goes to zero limit for the weak measurement of the position operator in that way, because there's no eigenstates. But you can talk about the spectrum of it, and then you can form projectors onto different intervals along in that spectrum. You could think about, in the case of L2 functions on R along X, your projectors are actually just indicator functions onto some particular subspace in X. So you can write down an ideal measurement formula, but then it's not the limit of the sigma goes to zero. Sorry, it's not the sigma goes to zero limit of the weak measurement case. And so you have to look at it starting from scratch.
Okay, yeah, thanks. It's more subtle than I realized. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Maybe like I have another question. So this, at the end, you also talked about the fermions and gauge fields. I'm not really very knowledgeable. But do these things satisfy the Hag property? And is it like a necessary thing in the proof of the weak causality implying?
So the way that we were going about it more recently, I'm not sure if we would need the Hager property as I stated, but there might be a sort of weaker condition. But I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that the fermionic field theory does satisfy the Hager property. I don't know about gauge theory, because gauge theory is a lot more complicated, especially in AQFT, from what I've seen anyway, or read. But the main initial hurdle with trying to just generalize our stuff to fermionic and gauge theory is that you, even to complex scalar field theory, you can't just write down the complex smeared field and then take an exponential of that to get the unitary kicks, because it's not a self-adjoint operator anymore. And then forming the kind of obvious self-adjoint operators from that, like phi dagger phi or whatever, doesn't give you something that's causal when you kick with it. So you have to, I think, be a bit more cunning.
Ding.
Hi again. Just a quick question. In the papers, you mentioned it would be interesting to look at the question from a path integral perspective. Do you know if anybody is doing work in this direction?
So I was starting to do stuff with the PhD student at Imperial, Emma Albertini. We didn't get particularly far. We were mainly focusing on finding a path integral analog to the ideal measurement question, or checking whether or not an ideal measurement is causal. I thought it would give us a nice intuition. But aside from that, no. And that would be something that would be really nice to explore if anyone is interested. And actually, I should say as well, a nice starting point with that, where everything is rigorously defined and fairly easy to deal with, a starting point for us was the Raphael Sorkin's work on the causal set path integral, the real scalar field path integral on some fixed causal set background. Because then the paths that you're dealing with are just, you're integrating over field configurations on the causal set. And so the integrals are all well-defined.
What about something similar like lattice field theory?
Yeah, or that would also be a good starting point. And I guess it would be quite connected to the causal set, which a causal set being a kind of very irregular looking lattice.
Okay, thank you.
So, okay, well, Lucien.
Maybe just one more question. So if you have, I'm not sure how to ask this question, but is there a kind of scaling? So if you have something that's allowed some at a certain scale, can you sort of then say, well, anything, if you magnify that, there's some kind of are the symmetries there, are your conditions symmetric with respect to scaling, I guess is the sort of question I'm asking.
That's a tough one. To me it sounds sort of related, but I'm not sure if it will be, but I'll say it anyway. When we were looking at the causal set analog to this, all of these questions about causality, because you now have a discrete space-time where there's this fundamental length scale and you can't go any smaller, then it means that for some situations, you can't form that Raphael scenario. If you look at a field that's just a single causal set element, for example. And so these are considerations that necessarily apply in that case. And it seemed like it was really relevant that in the continuum, you can always just go smaller. For whatever thing you're measuring, well, you could always go smaller and set up the Raphael scenario in precisely this way.
Yeah.
So I feel like any acausalness will have a similar flavor to it, where there's, I don't know, some sort of band or energy scale that you'd have to get to be able to detect the differences in the expectation values, say, to see this causality. I'm not sure if that quite answers your question, but
it's I mean, it's in the right ballpark. Yeah, good.
I think we, if there's no more questions, let's just thank Ian again. It was a very nice talk.